a lie when it happens, and they should try to call it out in real time. And there should be some solidarity. I still can't believe that the AP was banned from the White House, and all the mainstream media just didn't all walk out.
Right.
So this is a time our institutions, all our institutions, are under a threat. This is the Steve Bannon flood the zone. So there are so many outrages at once. All of our institutions are being attacked, including the media. My concern is Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. In my 50 years working on the programs, this is the most severe threat I've ever seen to them. I think everybody's got to be vigilant. I think they've got to make their voices heard. I know there's going to be a protest on April 5th. People should turn out for that. And the media should wake up and realize that everything is under assault, including them.
We've been speaking with Nancy Altman from Social Security Works. They're online at socialsecurityworks.org. Nancy Altman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Again, thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the National Media Watch Group, FAIR. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you'd like to listen to all the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll examine the Trump administration's attacks on public education in the U.S., with the appointment of Education Secretary Linda McMahon. Anne Hyslop, Director of Policy Development at All for Ed, will explain how McMahon's goal of ending the department will hurt disabled kids, low-income kids, and kids of color. Then we'll examine Trump's budget priorities, both in the short-term federal government budget and the long-term ideological pro-billionaire goals to strip public programs and enrich the rich. My guest will be Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Finally, João Paulo Connolly, Organizing Director at Working Partnerships USA, will close out the show explaining how people across California are fighting back against the pro-billionaire agenda with protests across the state. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Donald Trump's Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, has announced her intention to eliminate the department she was chosen to lead within weeks of her confirmation, as her first move in what she calls the department's, quote, final mission. She announced a 50% reduction in the Federal Education Department's workforce. The cuts disproportionately impact the Civil Rights Division, which critics say will most hurt disabled students. Trump's Education Department has also launched a special program to end initiatives aimed at diversity, equity, and inclusion. What does this mean for public education in the United States? Joining me to help answer that question is Anne Hislop. She is the Director of Policy Development at All for Ed, a national nonprofit advocacy organization committed to expanding equitable educational opportunities for students of color, students from low-income families, and other marginalized groups. Welcome to the program, Anne.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So many of us don't pay close attention to how our education system is set up, but let's just give ourselves a brief overview, right? Most education departments are, and most people's connection to public education stems through citywide districts that get state funding. But then there's, of course, the Federal Education Department that plays a big role, but is not the entirety of how public education is run. Give us a sense of how much impact the Federal Department of Education has on school districts nationwide.
That's a great question. So it's true that within at least K-12 education, typically only about 10% of funding comes from the federal government. 90%, again, on average, comes from state and local funding sources. But that doesn't mean that the federal government doesn't play an enormous role. In some states, actually, it is more than 10% of funding. You know, if you think about a state like Arkansas or Alaska, roughly 20% of their education funding comes from the federal Department of Education. But moreover, the federal government plays a hugely critical role in protecting and ensuring students' civil rights, particularly for students who historically were shut out of education by states and local school districts. You know, it wasn't all that long ago that students with disabilities did not have equal access to education and weren't held to the same standards as other kids. The same is true for Black students and Latino students, you know, who were kept in segregated schools. The U.S. Department of Education played an enormous role in ensuring that all students have an equal opportunity and equal access to a public education. And that role really continues today. In addition, outside of K-12, the U.S. Department of Education plays an enormous role in making college affordable and accessible for millions of students, both through the Pell Grant, which is, you know, a free sort of grant that is given to low-income students, but also just through running the federal financial aid program to provide students loans in addition to those grants. That is a critical role that the U.S. Department of Education plays. It's one of the biggest line items in the Department of Education's budget. And by cutting half of the staff at the agency, it's really going to inhibit the U.S. Department of Education from fulfilling those important responsibilities moving forward.
So here we have Linda McMahon. Who is she? Can you give us a sense of what her agenda is with the Department of Federal Education? It just is, I suppose, the way of conservative groups to reduce the role that publicly funded government programs play in our lives. And so when we have presidents coming in who put into place people who openly state that their goal is to shut down the department they are charged with running, I suppose we shouldn't be terribly surprised. And Linda McMahon has proclaimed just that in the interest, she says, of making education excellent.
Yes. So it seems like Secretary McMahon's main agenda item is to put the department on this final mission to eliminate it entirely and, you know, return education to the states. And in many cases, I think that also means not just returning education to the states, but trying to push more and more public dollars toward private schools in the form of either vouchers or what's called an educational savings account through the tax code, you know, really upending the federal role historically on its head by, you know, devolving every decision back to states and districts who, you know, historically haven't always made the best decisions on behalf of students of color, students from low-income families, students who are learning English, students who may have a disability, and, you know, also really undermining public education at its core by also really promoting public school funds to go to private schools that, you know, don't have the same protections and requirements as public schools. They can discriminate. They can say, we don't serve kids with autism at our school. We don't, you know, can't serve a student with that background because we charge, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a year in tuition, and that's unaffordable. So it's really fundamentally shaking what the federal and national role in education is. And most of this, her agenda, you know, does seem to come straight from the White House. She really has no background prior to this doing much of education policy at all. You know, recently had an interview where she didn't even know what the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act was, couldn't say what that meant. And that's really troubling for, you know, the person who is in charge of our federal education policy and should, you know, have a proactive, progressive, you know, visionary idea moving forward for what we should be doing in education, as opposed to taking us backward to a time where many students were simply shut out of public education and were not able to receive the type of schooling they needed to not only just graduate high school, but, you know, succeed beyond that and have a career and a job that was able to sustain a family and, you know, help them succeed in the economy.
So she's Betsy DeVos 2.0?
In some ways. I mean, I think although Secretary DeVos had much more of a history of working in education.
Right, so maybe worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, at least in terms of her prior, you know, prior background and prior work, she's done relatively little in education and was really a surprise to many people in the education community in terms of, you know, there was a lot of speculation of who might be selected. Oftentimes it's a, you know, former head of a state education agency or a district superintendent, maybe someone who's been a higher education system leader or president. You know, she was came out of left field and was a surprise to many folks.
And for our audience, DeVos was Trump's first Secretary of Education during his first term, who did a lot of damage to the education department. Let's specifically focus on disabled children. We have a, you know, public school system, K through 12 school system that, you know, has many flaws, of course, in large part because many of our districts don't get enough funding. And there has been a huge amount of work done by advocates of disabled kids, parents, and other disability justice groups for decades, right, to ensure that kids who might be on the spectrum, kids who might require the use of a wheelchair, kids who are in some way, you know, have a slightly greater struggle than other kids, have an equal opportunity at a quality education. They've done tremendous amounts of work, and a lot of that was funded by the federal Department of Education to have special ed programs or to essentially ensure that kids who live with disabilities have a level playing field. Do you worry that that is going to be impacted, particularly as the Civil Rights Office within the Department of Education, where a lot of the sort of complaints go from parents and others seeking to make a level playing field, those complaints go, now they're going to be essentially facing an office that is almost entirely destroyed?
I'm extremely concerned. You're right, nearly 8 million students across the country get some kind of special education services through the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. Those are students who have, what's often called an IEP, an Individualized Education Plan. And it's not just the funding, they are legally entitled, there's a legal right in federal law for those students to be able to access a free, appropriate public education. And the federal government is really the bedrock of that right. In addition to those 8 million students, an additional 1.5 million students are relying on what's called a Section 504 plan under the Rehabilitation Act. So when you think about the number of students who have supports and services because of the federal government, it's nearly 10 million students. And the U.S. Department of Education not only provides the funding to help states and districts support these students who do have outside needs. They may need special devices and technology to be able to access education or additional aides and staff support. It's the funding that matters, but also the role that the Civil Rights Office within the department plays in terms of handling complaints from parents when those rights are not being met. And if you cut 50% or more of the staff, that office was already understaffed. It already had a hard time addressing complaints in a timely fashion and resolving them and ensuring that school districts were paying attention. Here in my own state of Virginia, just in the last year or so, the U.S. Department of Education found that the Virginia Department of Education was not adequately informing parents when their child with a disability was not on track to earn a regular high school diploma. Parents were coming up on 11th and 12th grade and all of a sudden realizing that their kid wasn't going to be able to graduate from high school with that diploma. And that's not okay. And because of the Department of Education, that is being addressed now. And school districts are taking action to be sure that parents are aware if their student is not on that pathway to a diploma. That only happened because of staff at the Department of Education paying attention and addressing these complaints. And if you cut the staff, it can't serve that purpose. And a lot of complaints are going to go ignored and unaddressed.
I imagine that there are a lot of Trump supporters whose children rely on these programs who might be shocked that these programs are being impacted.
I think that's right. I think federal education policy, it's wonky and convoluted, and it's not always clear how the money and services from the federal government flows to states and school districts and ultimately to the principals and teachers that parents and families are interacting with every day. And I think that those connections are only, unfortunately, going to become clear when the services aren't being provided, when complaints aren't being addressed, when programs may be cut because of lack of funding or a grant that gets pulled away. Students with disabilities live across the country. They live in blue states and purple states and red states. This is something that affects everybody. And I think it's going to, unfortunately, just take the horrible actions to actually reach the classroom in order for some people to realize what is truly at stake here. We're certainly trying to raise the alarm now and to explain this in terms that make sense to folks who don't know the ins and outs of policy, but I think it's just the nature of our system, which is far more complicated than in many other countries, where you have this layer of tens of thousands of school districts across the country, in addition to 50 states, in addition to the federal government.
Right, and there are many reasons and that go back into history for why that is the way it is, and there's always been this push and pull, this struggle between those who advocate for the best possible standardized public education that has, that respects the civil rights of kids versus those who would like to, you know, they speak in terms of so-called school choice, which is just code for taking public funding and putting it into private hands, stripping teachers of union protections, et cetera. Let's talk also about Linda McMahon's announcement. And again, she's basically taking direction from the White House. The Federal Education Department has created a special portal to end DEI. And of course, DEI becomes this code word as well, because, and they don't like to spell it out. They don't like to say, those who are busy dismantling DEI programs don't like to spell out that we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. What is the Federal Department of Education's so-called portal to end DEI? What does that mean, and what impact would that have?
So I actually worked at the U.S. Department of Education about 10 years ago, and we used to say, as we were doing our work, you know, if the work that we were doing was directly impacting the classroom and that we were saying what teachers could and couldn't teach in school, we weren't doing our jobs. The Department of Education is actually prohibited by law from mandating any kind of curriculum or instructional materials. So creating a portal where parents and the public, or, you know, even folks who have no idea what's going on in schools, can, you know, snitch basically on educators who may be, you know, doing things in their, to make their classrooms inclusive and welcoming for all kids, is completely overstepping and inappropriate for what the federal role should do. Decisions about curriculum, about instructional programs, instructional practice are really made by local school boards, not by the U.S. Department of Education. So it's unprecedented, frankly, which is the case with so many things these days. I feel we are overusing that word, but to create some kind of hotline, you know, email address to call out individual educators when that's not what the federal government is supposed to be doing. You know, the federal government and the U.S. Department of Education are supposed to be ensuring that there are adequate resources for schools, that those resources are being targeted to the communities that are furthest from opportunity, and to ensure that, you know, student civil rights are being protected and that there's accountability and oversight for what states and school districts are doing. It's not to micromanage what's happening in the classroom.
So this, it's basically just a signaling, right? It's a kind of signaling to say that we do not like the idea of public education lifting up marginalized communities. So how is All for Ed, your organization, countering this? This is just a very dark time in our nation's history. And just at a time when our country is becoming more demographically diverse, which of course is no coincidence, we're seeing what are essentially white supremacist forces seeking to keep our country within this sort of caste system, or racial caste system, as well as, of course, keep disabled children disadvantage them. So how do we fight back against all of this?
I know we are trying our best. A lot of it is through education, you know, putting out materials and resources to make it really clear what the federal government's role is, what it is not, what is legal under the law, what is outside of the law, and, you know, not just sort of communicating with the public, but also talking to policymakers and politicians in DC, but also in states across the country. We also, I think, you know, work really closely with school districts across the country, many of whom are confused by the executive orders and all these different actions and what they mean, and are they changing the law? You know, and there's just a lot of education and support, because this is all by design. You know, there are so many executive actions that have occurred, and making heads or tails of them and understanding how this impacts a school district or a state is very complicated work. So that's a lot of what we're doing, but we're also trying to publicly speak out. You know, last week we were at a rally in supporting the U.S. Department of Education. Our CEO, who was the former Assistant Secretary for Adult Career, or for career, technical, and adult education at the U.S. Department of Education, she spoke out about the vital importance of the work that her office did and why we need to preserve a robust federal role. We also are monitoring state bills, though. It's not just that the federal activity, but we were just in Tennessee testifying against a bill that would essentially allow districts to not permit students who are undocumented from attending schools. It would give districts the ability to charge tuition to those students, and that would be in direct violation of a Supreme Court decision called Plyler versus Doe. So we are, you know, monitoring bills at the state and the local level, as well as federal, to try and push back. But it is hard work, and it's something that I think we are fortunate to be hand in hand with a lot of other advocates, because it's going to take a village.
And finally, this final mission, which, I mean, I just can't even, this final mission, so-called, that Linda McMahon, the Secretary of Education, has announced, and her, in her, as part of her intention to close the Department of Education, neither she nor Trump has the right to do that, right? There is literally no legal backing for that, because this is a department created by Congress. So we should remind ourselves that that is just not possible, unless, of course, we're living in a fascist authoritarian dictatorship, which is not out of the realm of possibility.
Congress created the Department of Education, and only Congress can eliminate it. Many of the positions within the department are mandated by law. So in a lot of ways, firing half the staff at the Department of Education is a runaround to get at that. You know, I think they know that they cannot actually close the Department of Education, but if you fire half the staff, how is that any different? You know, if there are no people to actually do the work, the agency cannot function. But it's absolutely true that this is a congressional authority. They created the department, and only they can do away with it. And I think in this area, like so many, waiting on Congress to put some pressure and act as that important check and balance on executive authority.
Well, give out a website, and for All for Ed, so our audience can check it out for themselves.
Yes, if you want to learn more, we are at www.all4ed.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Anne Hyslop, Director of Policy Development at All for Ed, which is a national nonprofit advocacy organization committed to expanding equitable educational opportunities for students of color, students from low-income families, and other marginalized groups. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer joined forces with President Donald Trump to pass one of the most reactionary federal budgets in recent memory. According to Mother Jones, the bill, quote, cuts non-defense spending by $13 billion and increases defense spending by approximately $6 billion, includes, among other steep cuts, a 57% slashing of the Defense Department's medical research programs, 44% cut to Army Corps of Engineers projects, which build and maintain essential infrastructure, and more than $3 billion in cuts to the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Community Development, Rental Assistance, and Homelessness Services programs. joining me to talk about how the policy discussions in Washington, D.C. can and will impact us and how this is essentially a billionaire's budget is Lindsay Koshkarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She co-authored a new report called The High Moral Stakes of the Policy Battles Raging in Washington. Welcome to the program, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Well, it was a certainly depressing turn of events that this bill passed. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised at what the bill included. And maybe we shouldn't be so surprised either that Chuck Schumer essentially rolled over and led the Senate into rubber stamping Trump's budget in the interest of averting a government shutdown. But this whole idea of it's either a federal budget or a government shutdown is still a relatively new thing, right? This idea that it's either or was something that was invented by Republicans, I don't know, maybe a decade or two ago, that every time we've had federal budget battles, they threaten a government shutdown, which is a way to sort of blackmail lawmakers. Usually there's a little bit more of a fight. This time, there was no fight whatsoever. Any reflections on how we got this budget?
Yes, Sonali. So like you said, the government shutdown threat is always sort of used as a hostage-taking technique, and they did it again this time. And what they ended up passing, as you said in your opening, was a budget that shifts funding from domestic priorities into the Pentagon, and they did also eke out a little smidge more for their mass deportation plans, about a little over $500 million for that. So they got a lot of what they wanted in this budget, and they did it with some Democratic cooperation, as you said. I do think it's significant that in the House, Democrats were almost perfectly united in voting against this. But it's also really important to remember that their budget is actually not done. There's a bigger step that they're still going to take through something called budget reconciliation. And through that, the Republicans want to cut huge amounts of money from Medicaid, food stamps. They want to add even more to the Pentagon budget, even more for mass deportations. And so that fight is still yet to come. And another thing that's really important about that is in this last budget vote, Democrats had the option to use the Senate filibuster, which of course they didn't take. But in the next fight on budget reconciliation, where they're going to address Medicaid and food stamps and more funding for the Pentagon and more funding for mass deportations and tax cuts for billionaires, for all of that, they only need simple majorities in the House and Senate. And so for that, we won't be worried so much about Chuck Schumer anymore.
Simple majorities are exactly what the Republican Party already has. They don't need the Democrats to pass in budget reconciliation these big cuts, which avoids them the debate. I mean, had Schumer put up a fight, even if there had been a minor government or short-term government shutdown, to be able to bring into the national dialogue that the end goal of the conservative budget is to slash the programs that millions of Trump supporters rely on, would have at least potentially, you know, created some kind of public outrage or just some kind of opposition, but they handed it to Trump on a silver platter. So here it is. I mean, it feels like if all they need now is simple majorities in the budget reconciliation process, it's over, right?
It's not over. It's not over because there are Republicans who will be sensitive to voters in their districts who will rely on Medicaid and food stamps. So it's actually not over. There's still months left to fight this. We can fight to limit the damage. We can fight to make people aware of what's in this budget so that when those cuts come home to roost and harm people, they will know exactly what happened and exactly who's to blame. And we can potentially win some of this, because there are, even though they have simple majorities in the House and Senate, their majorities are very narrow. And we've already seen, you know, voters come out in Republican districts and express their anger about a lot of the chaos that they're seeing in federal agencies with firings and all of that being done by Elon Musk. And so if we continue to put that kind of pressure on, it's not hopeless, even with simple majorities of Republicans in both the House and Senate. So it's important that we keep fighting that.
I appreciate your optimism, and you know, it's hard to not feel that, especially given that there just don't seem to be enough people defending the interests of the public among elected officials. It's hard to keep optimistic about this. Well, let's talk about the report that you helped to co-author. It was a collaboration, I understand, with several organizations, including Repairers of the Breach and the Economic Policy Institute. What's at stake if, in terms of the big picture? You know, it's one thing to have this sort of detailed federal budget discussion, but in the big picture, what is Trump saying that he wants to get done, him and his billionaire buddies? And what's on the chopping block?
Yeah, so we all know that there's chaos in Washington, with federal workers being fired, agencies being decimated, with no input from Congress. And one of the things that was so bad about the budget vote that we just saw was that one of the things Democrats and Senator Schumer caved on was actually handing over legitimacy to President Trump and Elon Musk for some of what they're doing. Through legislation saying that they can do some of these things. Many of them they cannot do. And so we're seeing attacks, and what we address in the report is that we're seeing attacks on multiple fronts. We're seeing, on the one hand, the executive actions and orders, things like the president's executive order to deny birthright citizenship, which has already met opposition from several courts and will probably continue to go forward in those court battles. And then the executive actions, like the firings that we're seeing in federal agencies, that's sort of one area where we're seeing the president's agenda play out. But the other that hasn't gotten quite as much attention, although it's starting to come into focus now with this budget vote that we saw last week, is what's happening in Congress. And that's where they're really working on this agenda, where they want to take away programs and services, basic services that serve people in this country. And they want to do it specifically in order to hand tax cuts and regulatory prizes and all kinds of government assistance, essentially, to the wealthiest people in this country and to corporations. And then they want to enforce their power through putting more money into the Pentagon and the war machine, and putting more money into their agenda for mass deportations. And all of this, of course, is creating fear and uncertainty and threats that will all ultimately serve to consolidate wealth and power for the president and his allies.
So we are in a situation where a president won based on populist rhetoric, and using this idea that he is going to make life better for ordinary Americans is essentially slashing the programs that help ordinary Americans, because they've sold this very effective and bizarre lie that any direct help by the government is actually bad for the people that the government is supposed to help. I just have a hard time, when we put it in those terms, it's so hard to figure out how we got here. But essentially, this is the free market agenda being pushed to its absolute limit, right? The so-called free market is something that everybody is supposed to be subject to. But they're not even doing that, because they're going further by helping billionaires. There's plenty of social safety net for the wealthiest people. So it's not even really free market, is it?
No, it's a very clear case of simply trying to hoard resources. They want to take programs and services away from ordinary people in order to hoard more wealth for those at the top. It's as simple as that. And I think it's also important to remember, you mentioned, the president coming in on a seemingly populist agenda that really was a Trojan horse agenda. And the president has said, as recently as the last few days, that he does not intend to cut programs like Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security. But if you look at the reality, he's also endorsed a budget that has already passed the first step in the House of Representatives that has no option but to cut Medicaid. They've said they want to cut $880 billion from the committee that oversees Medicaid, from that part of the budget. There is no mathematical way to cut that much money without touching Medicaid. There simply isn't that much money in the rest of that budget. So he's saying one thing and doing another thing. And one of the most important things that we have to do right now is to watch not what he says, but what he actually does.
And so, if we see cuts in Medicaid and Medicare, what would that look like on a state-by-state level? We've already seen in past years when the Affordable Care Act passed and there was more funding for states to access Medicaid, Republican-run states said, "No thanks. We would like for our, poor folks and elderly folks and disabled folks to suffer. We no thanks. We don't want this money that the federal government is giving us." But other states did take advantage of it. A lot of people who had no healthcare coverage had been covered. What should we be preparing for? And can states step in? There's only so much money because the federal government is the one that's collecting a lot of taxes from people.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Many states would have extreme difficulty covering the portions of Medicaid that are covered by the federal government right now. And there are even a handful of states that already have statutes on the books saying that if federal assistance for Medicaid ends, they will not fund it. So there are 36 million people in this country who are at risk of losing their health coverage under Medicaid, under the various Republican proposals. We haven't seen their final proposal yet, but some of the things they're talking about doing include, like you mentioned, cutting off the subsidies under Obamacare, that help people afford their health insurance, cutting off the expansion of Medicaid, that happened in many states, although not all, under the Affordable Care Act. And they are also talking about putting work requirements on people in order to get Medicaid. And the sort of two points about that are that, first of all, the vast majority of people on Medicaid who can work already do work. Those who don't, it's because they're caretakers or they have a disability that prevents their being able to work, or they're elderly. There are many, many people, older people get Medicare, but they also rely on Medicaid, and that's what often pays for, their living in nursing homes and things like that. So there are lots of people who won't be able to meet the work requirement. And then even people who are working, if they aren't able to meet the bureaucratic hurdles of submitting whatever paperwork is necessary on an ongoing basis to prove that they're working, which will be on them, it will not be on the government, it will be on the individual people, then they could be cut off from Medicaid even if they are working. So 36 million people at risk. We only have a population of about 330 million in this country. So that's more than one in 10 people in this country who are at risk of losing their health care.
There's also, of course, the issue of worker rights, and the report that that you helped to author discusses that. I mean, again, we have an administration who claimed that it was for ordinary working people. Unions are extremely popular in this country, even if they haven't been as successful at fighting, corporate employers. But there's a strong desire among the public to see people band together and be able to stand up to their employers because so many of us are struggling and suffering in this economy. What what should we be expecting from this administration when it comes to employment? You know, even basic wages. If Trump really cared about workers, he would champion a raise to the federal minimum wage, which is stuck at $7.25 an hour for, decades now?
Yes, that's right. The minimum wage is still $7.25, except in states where they've raised it higher. And it's been stuck there since 2009. And when you think of the inflation that we've experienced just in the last few years, to think that the minimum wage is stuck at $7.25 and has been there for more than 15 years now, without a change, despite all the inflation we've experienced. And then you consider that there are administration officials in this administration who in their Senate hearings said that they would not support raising the minimum wage. And the president has not expressed support for raising the minimum wage. That's one of the tells that they are not actually standing up for working people. Another, you mentioned unionization. One of the very first actions that President Trump did was to fire the head of the National Labor Relations Board, which is the body that oversees unionization rights and makes sure that people's right to unionize is upheld. And that wasn't just a simple firing. By firing this one person, the president took away the quorum from that body so that they're not able to do their work at all without this one person. And so he froze essentially the enforcement of labor rights. And so we're seeing all of these kinds of attacks. And I think it's also just important to notice that we're sold this myth that cutting taxes will create jobs and, you know, that billionaires and corporations are these job creators. But if you look at Elon Musk, he's not only firing thousands of government workers right now, but he's done the same at his private companies. He's done the same at the website formerly known as Twitter. He's done the same at Tesla. They have had massive layoffs in those companies. And so these are not people who primarily see themselves as job creators. And I think it's important that we remember that.
And we have, they have Trump supporters celebrating the firing of thousands of federal government workers, public servants, because I think they imagine that these are, elite politicos, when of course they're ordinary Americans, national park rangers. And it's just quite remarkable that in the guise of claiming to be pro-worker, that they have their voters, that this administration has its voters celebrating mass firings of people who help our country to run.
Yes, there is a clear glee that they have in firing many of these people. And, I think it's important to remember that this is all ideologically motivated. Yeah. They say it's about waste, fraud, and abuse. But meanwhile, they've cut almost the entirety of USAID, which has already led to deaths in many countries around the world and will possibly lead to 6 million deaths from HIV in the coming years if we don't reinstate the amazingly successful HIV programs that are the only positive legacy of President George W. Bush that are around the world. So many, many deaths. They stopped a program to monitor Ebola, which is clearly a public health issue for the entire world. So it's not about waste, fraud, and abuse. And if it were, they would look more closely at the Pentagon, where they say they're looking, and there have been a handful of firings, but what they haven't touched at all is the Pentagon contractors. And of course, it's important to remember that both Elon Musk is himself a Pentagon contractor with his company SpaceX. They've received billions of dollars in Pentagon funding. That Pentagon contracts, if they were a federal agency, would be bigger than any other federal agency that's being targeted for firings right now. So those things are clear indications that they are not really after waste, fraud, and abuse. They are on an ideological war against government services and against government programs.
Give out a website, Lindsay, where people can find out and read the document and the report that you've co-authored.
Yes, the report is available at the Institute for Policy Studies website. It's ips-dc.org.
And we'll link to that directly from our site as well. Lindsay, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Lindsay Kashgarian, Program Director at the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, co-author of the report, The High Moral Stakes of the Policy Battles Raging in Washington. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A California coalition of advocacy organizations has come together this week to protest the impacts of the pro-billionaire budgeting decisions being taken in Washington, aimed at publicly funded programs to benefit ordinary people. As part of a hands-off healthcare series of actions across California, activists are targeting, among other things, Elon Musk's SpaceX program and Tesla showrooms from San Diego to San Jose and major cities in between. My guest is Joao Paulo Connolly, the organizing director at Working Partnerships USA and a member of We Are California. His work is focused on helping tenants and workers. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sonali. It's good to be here.
So first, let's start by discussing the way in which you think California is going to be impacted. California has a reputation for being liberal. Sometimes it doesn't stand up to that or hold up to it. But in general, especially when we're talking about the Trump administration, and Trump very openly expressed anathema and antagonism towards California. What does California represent at a time when Trump is in the White House?
Well, we represent many things, but what's important to understand is that the budget cuts that are being discussed are going to harm our communities in critical ways. We're talking about defunding resources that really hold our communities together in so many ways. We're talking about healthcare. We're talking about access to food resources in our communities. And so that impact is going to be massive. It's going to be felt by all of us across the state of California, and that's why we're coming together and mobilizing right now to say that we're going to defend the things that we love about this state and the things that make this state special, and we're not going to allow Trump and his billionaire cronies to intimidate us.
So what are some of the actions that are taking place? How have you picked the focuses, if you will, of the protests, and who is organizing them? Give us a sense of what's happening this week in California.
Yeah, I mean, what we're witnessing is, you know, as part of We Are California, this rolling series of mobilizations across the state, really. So starting on Tuesday, March 18th, with an action in San Diego, and then we're going to see an action in Riverside County, an action in Orange County. On March 19th, actions in Los Angeles and Bakersfield, actions in Fresno and Sacramento on March 20th. And then on Friday, March 21st, a large mobilization in the Bay Area. And so we're seeing a series of mobilizations really moving across the state of California. And what all of these communities have in common, everybody is rising up to say, you know, we're gonna defend, we're gonna insist that these critical resources, healthcare resources, these are not luxuries, right? When we talk about full scope coverage under Medi-Cal, we're talking about resources that save lives. We're talking about resources that help patients in our communities get life-saving cancer screenings. We're talking about resources that help families keep food on the tables. And these really hold together the fabric of our communities in so many critical ways. So these actions are parents, teachers, students, working families, faith ministers, you know, tenants, really folks from all across our communities. And what we all have in common is we're all saying that we're not going to allow these billionaires to, you know, bring their electric chainsaw and slash at the resources that hold our communities together and that are so important to all of us.
California is a powerhouse economy, a fifth largest economy in the entire world. It's the most populous state in the nation. It is also home to Silicon Valley, where tech bros and billionaires have made their money and are now, you know, doing wrong by not just the state, but the entire country. Is that part of why California actions such as these are important?
Yeah, we have such a critical role to play here in the state, right? I mean, if we think about Tesla, Tesla makes a huge amount of its fortune in the state of California, right? We represent a huge piece of Tesla's consumer base in this state. And so we have these billionaires who are openly attacking our values, values that we all care about. I mean, I believe that if voters in California, voters across the United States took a closer look at what some of these guys like Peter Thiel are talking about, people like Curtis Yarvin, if they took a closer look at the projects that some of these billionaire bros from Silicon Valley have, I mean, this is scary stuff. This is not stuff that American working families are on board with. You know, this is not stuff that our communities have endorsed or supported. This is a radical project that's being imposed on us. It's really a kind of a billionaire coup, a takeover, a raid of our communities. And so we believe that, you know, we have a real unique responsibility. You know, I'm talking to you right now here from Silicon Valley, and our food banks have, you know, there are lines at our food banks. You know, there's massive food insecurity in this community. There are folks struggling to access healthcare resources already. And yet, you know, we see the tremendous wealth that is generated here in our backyards, right? And so that has to stop. That inconsistency just, you know, it's not democratic, and it's not what our communities want or need. And so we are coming together, and we're insisting that there's a better way, right? We can build a state where everyone can thrive, and we deserve that.
And yet we also have a governor who seems to, at this moment, be trying to appease the right. I don't know, become a member of the right. Governor Gavin Newsom has a new podcast, and he's been busy interviewing white supremacists and Trump MAGA people, Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon. Is he at odds with, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but is he at odds with what ordinary Californians need right now?
I mean, I think what ordinary Californians need is leadership, right? And leadership that is not afraid to stand up to billionaire power. I think what ordinary Californians want is leadership that is willing to fight for working families who are struggling right now, willing to fight to defend, Medicaid, Medi-Cal, right? These resources that are really critical to the budgets of all of our counties. And we all know people. We all know people who are directly impacted by this stuff, right? And then, you know, we're also seeing right now this new, continuing resolution on the budget that we just saw, which really allows for, it allows for DOGE to continue its attacks on Social Security. It allows for DOGE to continue its attacks on the federal workforce, on the VA. I mean, we're talking about critical resources, that benefit our neighbors, that benefit our own family members, our parents, our grandparents. And all of this is under attack. And so I think what ordinary Californians want is someone who's going to defend and fight to protect Social Security right now. You know, we're all hearing these scary stories, right? A person in Seattle pronounced dead, Ned Johnson. He wasn't dead. And yet DOGE, you know, declared him dead. And so he had to go and prove that he wasn't dead. I mean, this is scary stuff.
Just so
right?
You could,
I mean,
collect Social Security, right?
Yeah. So he had his Social Security cut, right? So we think about our own parents, we think about our own family members, and the risk that, you know, some 19-year-old tech bro at DOGE can just decide to, like, change a few numbers in the system, and will our own family members be cut out of Social Security? We don't know. There's no accountability and there's no oversight. I mean, this is the stuff that we have to defend, because this is what holds together the fabric of our communities. This is the, you know, this is the social contract that we've all been upholding, and it's so important to who we are as a state.
And yet, you know, we should also remind ourselves that there were a lot of Californians who did vote for Trump, although, of course, their vote didn't count because of the Electoral College. They did vote for him. And I don't know if they were expecting, you know, they also use Social Security. They also rely on Medicare and Medicaid. They also have family members who are national park rangers or might be undocumented. Trump's agenda and the pro-billionaire agenda, I don't know if they necessarily knew what they were voting for. And I'm wondering if there's any potential to win them back, if you will, from what they've done.
Of course there is. I mean, I think that very few working class people have taken a close look at the agenda that Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and this tech right has for the working class. These are not people that like or respect workers. These are not people that like or respect people who are struggling to get by and families who are struggling to put food on the table. I mean, they see poor and working people as at best a nuisance, right? They think of democracy as something that is passe, right? And so I think that, you know, there might be a range of reasons why folks have voted for Trump, but the truth of the matter is that the more we learn about this awful billionaire agenda and this awful billionaire raid of our communities, the more all of us should have reason to be pissed off and to rise up and to demand leadership that is going to fight for and with working people.
Give out a website where people can find out more about these actions that are taking place this week. I imagine you'll have more coming up in the future.
Yes, they can go to We Are California, and that's wearecalifornia.org. They can sign up, they can join. I mean, if you're watching this right now, I invite you to join. We Are California is a movement made by all of us. So you can join us and help us build We Are California and help us defend the things that we love and care about and the things that are so important to us in our community and in this state.
Well, we'll post a link to that as well from our website. Thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been João Paulo Connolly, Organizing Director at Working Partnerships USA and a member of We Are California. I'm Sonali.
This is Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my